Are you ready for the most ridiculous internet sports show you have ever seen? Welcome to React, home of the most outrageous and hilarious videos the web has to offer. So join me, Rocky Theus, and my co-host, Raiders Pro Bowl defensive end, Max Crosby, as we invite your favorite athletes, celebrities, influencers, entertainers in for an episode of games, laughs, and of course, the funniest reactions to the wildest web clips out there. Catch React on YouTube, and that is React, R-E-A-X-X. Don't miss it.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Regressing to the mean since 2015, it's the Hockey PDO Cast with your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Justin Bourne. Justin, what's going on, man?
Well, you know, not a whole lot. Just basking in the misery of a Toronto Raptors loss here, but surviving, having a cup of coffee. The sun came up. Successful day.
Yeah. It was quite a game, and we're gonna. You and I talked a bit before we went on the air about it, and we're gonna stick to hockey on today's podcast because there is so much to get to. I haven't recorded in a while, and I'm excited. I mean, obviously, just the idea of a Stanley Cup final, Game 7, we haven't had it in so long, and really, with all on the line in that one game, the drama and then entertainment storylines kind of speak for themselves. But I do think it's fitting that this series is going 7 because maybe the individual games haven't been all as close as we'd like, but I think by my count, it feels like the Bruins have been the better team 3 times and the Blues have been the better team the other 3 times. So it feels like it is kind of fair that we're going to be deciding this in a winner take all.
It does. At the same time, I get the vibe, you know, back in 2011 when the Canucks beat the Bruins, or sorry, the Canucks lost to the Bruins. When they would win their games, they would win like 1-0. Yeah. I believe there were multiple, actually, you're probably there. I think they won 1-0 twice, maybe 2-1. It was always like they escaped by the skin of their teeth. And then when Boston won, it was like, oh, right. Like that was supposed to happen. 8-1 Boston, whatever, you know, whatever the scores were, they were very lopsided in Boston's favor. So by the time Game 7 rolled around, it kind of felt like Boston should win the series, even though I was pulling for the Canucks as being a BC boy. But, you know, sitting where I sit now, it kind of feels like that in this series. When Boston wins, they win by a few. It feels like they should. When St. Louis wins, it feels like they're just squeaking by. So, yes, I would say 3-3 is a pretty fair score situation right now, but it certainly feels to me like Boston is a team that should and probably will win the series.
But it's weird because just from a stylistic perspective, and we can get into why this is, and I know you've written about it a little bit as well, and it's kind of come up to anyone that's been watching, but just when the Blues do get going, it's weird because the Bruins usually do this to other teams, and we've seen them do it to them throughout this postseason when they are really playing their game, especially at 5-on-5. There's this kind of like avalanche effect where they just keep the puck in the offensive zone, and all of a sudden there's a flurry of shots, and you feel like a goal is inevitable. With the Blues, it seems like they've kind of turned it on them where they get that offensive zone cycle going and they get the puck moving in the offensive zone. And all of a sudden, it looks like the Bruins are just running around and looking like the inferior team. And so when you watch the Blues and they are playing at their absolute best, they look like they're the best team you've ever watched.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And for me, I love, you know, one of my favorite situations to watch in hockey is 5-on-5 offensive zone play. And to see what teams can create off that. And the Blues are really good at, for lack of technical terminology, what I used to call it, the Marlies, was having it. Some players are just good at having it. Some teams are good at just having it. They have the puck for a long time. It wears down their opponent. It tires out their legs. There's great benefits to having it. But they don't seem to have those guys that, you know, score those quick strike plays, those that, that seem to come out of nowhere, that, that exciting creation play. They've had some success, you know, generating goals off that, those extended cycles in this series. But, you know, the three best offensive players in the series, you can argue might be all on the Marchand line, you know, depending how you feel about O'Reilly and Tarasenko. But still, so those, yes, those Blues possessions are fantastic. And they are certainly good in doing damage to the Bruins, but I just feel like they don't quite have the guys to turn those into goals quite often enough, or at least they haven't often enough in this series.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it just has been surprising me. I want to get your take kind of from a tactical perspective about how the Blues are pulling that off in terms of that sort of, not necessarily even the prototypical or traditional forecheck that we think of, but sort of just when they dump the puck in and then how they're so good at retrieving the puck more often than not. It feels like, I don't know, like, is it, it seems to me just from watching it that it's a lot of, they're activating their defensemen a lot and getting really aggressive in terms of the pinches and getting them involved in it as well, and causing turnovers from the Bruins defensemen. And obviously not having Matt Grizzlick hurts the Bruins quite a bit there in terms of having a guy who can go back, retrieve it, and exit the puck cleanly. But how are they like pulling that off? And is it more of a personnel thing, or do you think it's more of a tactical thing where Craig Berube's come in and tapped into something that's made them so effective?
Well, I think, you know, when you coach a roster, you basically look at what you have and you assess, you know, how do I get the most out of this? How do I make this group the toughest group to possibly beat? And whether Berube has done that or just his style happens to mesh well with the personnel they do have, it's impossible to say. But for whatever reason, his style and the Blues style is perfect for one another. It's just that physical, go get it. You know, we can't control everything necessarily, but we can control our effort. And the Blues on the forecheck, you know, you can see the Bruins scrambling to get back on pucks because they know once they get out of the zone, once they even get it past the first forechecker, they've usually been pretty effective at doing something decent with it and moving the play the other way. It's just the Blues have been so good at getting in on them. And, you know, they have a lot of those guys. You know, not even necessarily the big guys, even the guys like David Perron who aren't big, and, you know, Jaden Schwartz isn't big, but some of these guys that still manage to get in there and get on the forecheck and be annoying, really compliment the guys who are bigger, you know, a guy like Sanford who gets in there and lays the body. So Barbashev and Sundqvist, and they just happen to have the right personnel with the right mindset, I think, for that style of play. And so for the Bruins, it's pretty black and white, you know, if you go back on that puck and have your first touch be quality, your team's probably going to be doing pretty good. If you turn it over after that first touch, good luck. You're spending the next 45 in your own zone.
Yeah, I mean, the Point Hockey tweeted this out the other day, but the slot shots in this series of 5-on-5 are 82-68 for St. Louis, and the offensive zone possessions 33 minutes for St. Louis and 22 for Boston, and that kind of shows that how effective that sort of cycle and that offensive zone pressure has been for them. And obviously, it's, you know, as we look ahead to Game 7 and try to figure out how this is going to go and who's going to win and what the sort of X factors are going to be, I mean, it's typically going to come down to, you know, whichever goalie plays better or a couple bounces here or there. But I have noticed that as this series has gone along, and maybe this is just kind of a random thing, maybe it is because it's ridiculous that we're playing games this late into June and it's getting hot and humid and the ice conditions aren't as good as they were once, but the puck has been bouncing quite a bit and it's been all over the place. And I do wonder whether a more kind of volume-based approach where you're just keeping the puck down low and getting it on net as much as possible might be the advantageous way to go compared to trying to thread the needle and make one skill precise play to win the game.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Absolutely agree. I would say that at this time of year, when you're the more skilled, more talented team, you want everything to go in your favor. You know, that favors true talent dictating the outcome, right? You'd like nice, cold, hard, fast ice, everything nice and smooth. You know, you'd like no weird bounces. You want that puck frozen right. You know, every opportunity you have for things to go as you intend them to go would be ideal. This series, you're right, the ice has been bad. The Blues are probably more volume-based approach. So certainly, you know, I would say if luck is going to rear its ugly head in Game 7, if anything, that probably plays in the Blues' favor.
Well, you know what? It's human nature. No matter how well it's going and how good the hockey is, we have to find something to latch onto and complain about. And at this point, you know, there's nothing really new to say about the officiating. Like, I think it's just been uniformly bad and inconsistent, and both teams have reasons to gripe about it. But I think for me, the new fascination is just, like, how ridiculous it is that the season is stretching this long. And I know there's still basketball going on as well, but it feels like the fact that we're going to be having an important hockey game on June 12th. Like, listen, I love watching hockey. I love that this is going to game seven. I love all that. But it just seems like, I don't know, this is going on forever. Like, you and I are obviously still very tuned in and interested. But don't you feel like, based on fan interaction and maybe people kind of like checking out a little bit and doing other stuff, it feels like it's probably not the best way to market your sport on like the most important game of the season?
Well, it's the stupidest thing, too, because, like, you know, for me, September is the turning point on the calendar. Like, summer's not over. You still get to reap the benefits of some decent weather, but things are turning. Kids are going back to school. NFL football's starting to come back. Like, it's, you know, you're starting to get to wear scarves. Oh, everyone looks good in a scarf and a mock turtleneck, even for you, if you're feeling weird. You know, it's that time of year. Everything turns, and that's when hockey should start. It would be the perfect time of the year to get things going. September, I'm ready to get back in the rinks. I've missed it. I've had my fun at the lake. You know, I've been on the golf courses, and I'm ready for hockey. So the fact that we don't drop the puck on the season till October 8th, I think it is, most years, somewhere in that ballpark, it's ridiculous. We don't need a month of preseason. You know, you're totally right that the fact that we're talking hockey here in June 12th, you know, there's no reason to try to have the season run concurrently with the NBA. If anything, staggering it from the NBA would be more advantageous. So, yeah, this seems a little late in the season to be late in the year to be talking hockey.
Well, and it feels like the players' bodies are certainly feeling it too. Like, I guess you could make the argument that maybe a little additional rest here and there with an extra added day off between games 4, 5, 6, and 7 or whatever is doing them well. But at the same time, like, people are always wondering right now, like, what's going on with Patrice Bergeron? Why isn't the Bruins top line producing? And it's like, I guarantee when this series is over, we're going to hear that Bergeron was playing at like 40% functional capacity and had like 4 surgeries and his limbs are barely hanging on to his body at this point. Like, it's ridiculous.
Last time they won the cup, they were like, yeah, he had a punctured lung, actually. It was like a punctured lung? You can play with that?
I know, it's so obscene, and I don't know, but it is good. I mean, for the Bruins, obviously, the fact that it does come down to this one game, and that they have, I mean, I think their first 5-on-5 goal created by that top line was Pastrnak's goal that made it 4-1 in game 6, mm-hmm. and Bergeron wasn't even on the ice for that, and when you see a stat like Bergeron's line's been outscored 5-0 so far in this series, you'd be like, oh my god, there's no way that they could have won 3 games so far. And I guess considering that they have had their chances and they have been generating stuff, it feels like eventually they're going to break through. Might not come in time. Maybe they don't break through in game 7 and they lament it all summer, but it does feel like there's something percolating here where they could break through and score a couple big goals in game 7.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I kind of wrote about that a little bit today. I alluded to golf and talked about the Masters and how there are plenty of tournaments where these random tournaments in like February where a no-name player kind of pokes their head in on a Sunday and they manage to win a tournament. It's a nice surprise and all that. On Sundays, you don't tend to see those guys survive. They wilt, they fade, they can't handle the pressure and the big boys in the moment. To me, the Boston Bruins are the big boys. They've been there. They're five. They have 5 players who won the Stanley Cup in 2011. And they're 5 players who are their most important players, beyond a shadow of a doubt. So to me, their core is still those guys. The Blues haven't been in this situation. They haven't had to answer to the moment or anything to that effect. So when it comes down to it, Game 7 in Boston, spotlight on. You know, I'm not saying the Blues are going to wilt. I expect the Bruins, those guys, they have to show up at some point. They're too good to go through this series with just sort of a whimper, and that's really all we've seen from them. So that would be focus number one if I'm the St. Louis Blues, is we got to keep them quiet for one more night, and we'll take our chances with the rest of the team.
Well, another thing is, you know, we focus and latch onto their offensive production, and obviously they drive so much of that for the Bruins throughout the year, but I think it's no coincidence that this is happening while they're basically being tasked with going out against Tarasenko and Schwartz as much as possible. And clearly the Bruins have identified that as a big sort of sticking point for them, where they have to make sure to limit what those guys are doing on the other end of the ice. So there is that kind of fascinating matchup interplay as well, where it's like, I'm sure that sometimes the defensive responsibilities come into it a little bit as well. And I'm not making any excuses for them, because we've seen them time and time again play against the other team's best lines and still generate their 5-on-5 offense. But I'm sure that's having a little bit to do with it as well.
Yeah, I just think you look at every team in the playoffs, or, you know, every team that had to play, maybe Carolina is a bit of an exception, but there's always a great line on the other team. At this time of the season, there's always a great line, and certainly, you know, they would have some defensive responsibility in that regard, but I don't think that top line, the Blues, is any better than anything else they've had to see throughout their career. So that's not to say that they're not doing a good job or not, you know, facing a tough matchup and being handed tough assignment. But as you mentioned, that's something they're familiar with, and I think we're within our rights, given their stature, their salaries, and the rest, to expect them to do better than they've done thus far.
Well, here's the thing. I thought that after game six, my like hot take or thing I was going to really latch on to these next couple of days was going to be, I think Tuukka Rask should be the Conn Smythe, regardless of if the Bruins win or lose in game seven. And obviously that's dependent on him not getting blown up and giving up six goals in game seven or something like that. But I do think he's probably been objectively the most valuable or most dominant, consistent player throughout this postseason. But my next one is, if the Blues do win, because we so rarely see a player from the losing team win it, I think Colton Parayko has actually been the Blues' most valuable player. What do you think about that?
I think it's great. I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to bring up. Well, I get frustrated because, you know, you see some of the biggest names in hockey put like Twitter polls out there or write articles, and they're saying, you know, who's it going to be? Is it Rask or Bennington or O'Reilly? Or, you know, it's kind of where it ends for the most part, the conversation. I've seen Jaden Schwartz's name get brought up, which before the series is reasonable, but at this point to me isn't. For me, if St. Louis does win, it's maybe Bennington. If O'Reilly has a big night, you could talk me into O'Reilly. But does any of this happen without Colton Parayko? Like, Jay Bouwmeester has been handed the toughest minutes of maybe any defenseman in the NHL playoffs, and the only reason he hasn't gotten eaten alive like a frozen corpse on the, you know, like at a crashed airplane or something, is because Parayko has helped him out. Parayko has dragged him through. This guy gets not nearly enough love, and he's the ultimate testament to the fact that we really love goals and assists and goaltenders and all that more than we should, because I don't think the Blues have a prayer of doing what they've done without Parayko.
He might honestly be the perfect player. Like, if you went into a lab and constructed a defenseman, I think it would have his attributes.
What's so crazy is that like a year ago, I don't remember the date, but Tyler Della wrote something for The Athletic to the effect of that the Toronto Maple Leafs should offer sheet Colton Parayko. And, you know, it comes off as one of those things that you read and you're like, oh, yeah, that's a neat idea. But in retrospect, it's like, no, that should have happened regardless of the cost, given their needs. You know, the fact that the league just like lets guys like him go to RFA, sign new deals and move on without any sort of, you know, flinching at or making a push for him, is ridiculous. You're right. He's damn near a perfect defenseman, and everyone's like, yeah, you guys just sign him cheap. That's fine.
Well, it's like the size and the reach and the mobility are obviously awesome and great attributes, and if that was alone what he brought to the table, you'd be like, oh, you have Brandon Carlo. That's a really good, valuable player. And then it all of a sudden has like a massive shot, actual like creativity and just sort of like this kind of offensive hockey sense where he jumps into the play when he needs to. And I feel like maybe if we were in a different situation playing for a team that was a bit more lenient in terms of their structure and maybe was willing to trade chances and go back and forth a bit more, he could probably even put up bigger offensive numbers and really be more on the mainstream or forefront of the top two-way defensemen in the league. But yeah, what he does is just so good.
So sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, but if you asked GMs around the league if you could have Parayko or Carlo, who do you want? A big number of them say Brandon Carlo, because one thing Parayko does is he doesn't hit.
Yeah.
He doesn't play physical with that big body. He uses his big body defensively and to get body position and to do all sorts of amazing things. But the quote-unquote hockey men love the physical play. And for his size, like Victor Hedman, he's not a physical player.
Yeah, but here's the thing. He definitely doesn't use his body that way. And I think people probably watch that and leave a bit disappointed because they're just like, oh, he could be doing so much more with that frame. But we talk about why Bergeron, Marchand, and Pasternak have struggled at 5-on-5 and how they haven't scored yet. And it's like they're seeing a lot of Bouwmeester and Parayko, and just watching. And I know throughout the year, like when Pasternak is coming down the wing or Marchand's coming down the wing, there's the best in the league at carrying it in with possession and then creating something off the rush, and just watching them like either completely avoid Parayko's side of the ice or kind of they get these like footsteps sort of that they're hearing, kind of like with a great shot blocker in the NBA where it's like he might not even block the shot or he might not get a stick on it, but you're getting rid of it a second or a fraction of a second earlier than you would ideally like to, just because you have that in the back of your mind that he could probably get to it.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of panicking, and watching that interplay and that kind of cat and mouse game has been really fun to watch in this series. And so, yeah, you're right. And the physicality, I mean, people view that as a negative. He's drawn more penalties at 5-on-5 this postseason that he's taken, which, considering the fact that he's playing against the other team's best players, is one of my favorite stats.
And his D partner, Bouwmeester, is just the complete opposite. He's taken the most minor penalties of any St. Louis Blue and drawn zero. So in the same matchups, you can tell who's hanging on for dear life and the other person who's not having any trouble treading water. So, he's certainly a special player. And you're right, that's kind of the Joel Embiid theory of defense in the NBA, where people are like, I'm just not going to go to that part of the court because that's where he is. And Parayko is that. For the Blues, the tough thing is a forward in hockey, you're never exactly sure if the D have switched, who's coming to get you in the corner, who's where on the ice. You know, of course, if you get your head up and check, you will, but you don't always know. So when you're out there against that pair, you have to assume you're against the better defender. So Bouwmeester, in that regard, he gets the benefit of the doubt of guys rushing some plays, thinking it might be Parayko. It's just kind of another way where Parayko's numbers wouldn't have as much of an effect to show how positive he's helped Bouwmeester, but it's certainly pretty evident to watch.
Absolutely. Justin, let's take a quick break here to hear from a sponsor, and then we're going to keep going on the other end of things. Sponsoring today's episode of the Hockey PDOcast is SeatGeek. Everyone can obviously agree that going to the event is the fun part of the process, but the act of actually getting there and procuring your tickets shouldn't be as complicated as it's been in the past. Some of these websites over the years have made it so off-putting to actually put yourself out there and go to an event because of all the lags and the loopholes, and you click on a seat and then it turns out it's not actually available, and then there's all these added fees at the end, and it's such a nuisance that sometimes you feel like you're better off just staying home and skipping out on the event, even though you know it could be a really fun night. And so you don't need to worry about that anymore, because with millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek is changing the game and proving that there's a better way to buy tickets. You can search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek's got the tickets you're looking for all in one place. In an industry that tends to stagnate, SeatGeek's decided to stand out from the crowd by building the fastest way to find tickets so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. The reason why SeatGeek is the best is because they're going to do all the work for you. They pull millions of tickets together from all over the web into one place. Then they rate each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, and they display all of those results on an interactive seat map. So they break down the details for you, so all you have to really look for is the green dots, which mean that the ticket you're looking for is a good deal, and you stay away from the red dots, which indicate overpriced tickets. And every purchase with them is, as I mentioned, fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence, knowing that what you're paying for is what you're going to get. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I've found time and time again that it's the fastest, easiest way to find tickets, and it'll also save you the most money. I've used it for basketball games, baseball games, football, hockey, so on and so forth. I mean, obviously now, considering we're heading into Game 7 here, the Stanley Cup Final, there's no more hockey games to go to this season. But, you know, with it being summer, there's tennis on, there's baseball on, obviously. I mean, there's outdoor concerts. It's still, even though it is going to be the off season, there's still plenty of stuff going on around you regardless of where you're at. So definitely go out to SeatGeek and check out what's available in your town, and maybe you can find a fun event to go to spend a nice summer night at. And the best part is, if you're still somehow not convinced that SeatGeek's the way to go, they're going to give you $10 off your first purchase with them for listening to today's episode of the Hockey PDOcast. All you have to do to claim that is use our promo code. So just download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code PDO today for $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code PDO for $10 off your first purchase. Now let's get back to Justin Bourne. Well, and the other thing that's really interesting to me is, you know, you kind of brought up this idea of sort of the quality of teammate, right? Or the effect that of who you play with affects your underlying numbers. And that kind of ties into the other end of the coin, which is the quality of competition or who you're playing against. And I know that's been a hotly debated topic over the years in hockey Twitter and in terms of our analysis. And I bring that up because of a guy like Alex Pietrangelo, where I felt like there was this kind of mismatch over the years in terms of how sometimes people would talk about him. He'd always be on in Hockey Canada. People would always talk about him for the Norris and as one of the top players. And then you'd actually look at his underlying numbers and you'd go like, he's not really doing that well. Like, he's okay. I think he's fine. Like, he certainly passes the eye test when you watch him. He's very smooth and prolific out there, but there was always something missing there. And, you know, I've been giving this a lot of thought, and I was looking at it, and for years they would rely on him and Jay Bouwmeester to just play always against the other team's best players, and I'm sure that had its effect. And I don't think it's any coincidence now that as Parayko has kind of stepped up and taken that mantle from him and is eating up all those tough minutes, Parayko's, you know, they're still playing him against that Bergeron line, but not exclusively. So he's getting minutes against the softer players. He's getting some easier breakouts. He's getting some more offensive zone time, and then all of a sudden, I don't think it's any coincidence that he looks as good as he does. I think that game four he had in St. Louis was probably as flawless a game I've seen a defenseman play in some time.
Yeah, actually, I forget when exactly it was. I went through their minutes that they had matched up 5-on-5. But I believe it was after the fourth game, and Pietrangelo had basically not seen Bergeron. It was like a minute and a half of 5-on-5 time in that fourth game, and you're right. All of a sudden, you look like an all-star when you're going against another team's third line. And that's great. That's the value of a guy like Parayko. That's why you and I are talking about him, is that you free up somebody to do so much more. You make your teammates better in ways that are really not measurable. I guess they are measurable, but they're difficult to measure. So that's certainly another point for Parayko. But, yeah, I'm with you. Pietrangelo, he's a guy whose contract is going to be – you know, he's going to make a lot of money here, and I'm not sure that he has the type of effect that can back up the dollars and cents he's going to see.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, certainly it seems like a good opportunity for them to eventually cash in. I know that he means a lot to that franchise and has been there for some time and had some great moments for them, but just based on sometimes the way you hear people talk about him and write articles about him, you're like, are we watching the same player?
Yeah. It's like once your name gets elevated to a certain level, we're not allowed to like look back and reassess how things have gone since. It's like Mark Edward Vlasic or, once you're on Team Canada, the way people talk about you and look at you certainly changes. And it's something that's never going to go away in professional sports and in life, really. You make your reputation and people start to think of you a certain way. It's really tough to change their mind after that first impression.
It is. Well, that's just like when a guy gets drafted, and especially high and like especially as a lottery pick, it's like you get a healthy dose of chances bouncing around the league before people finally go like, you know what, we can't salvage anything from this. Whereas if you're like an undrafted guy or a guy drafted in the later rounds, you really need to make an impression right out of the gate or you might just never get your chance.
God, it's so true. And it's such a painful thing for undrafted players who just sometimes never really get that shot. Because not to mention, if you are the drafted player, the organization stands to benefit from looking smart. So they put you in situations with easier quality competition, better quality of teammate. You're fighting an uphill, you're swimming upstream as an undrafted player. So, I don't know how many teams Anthony Duclair could end up playing for by the time this is all said and done. But at some point you're like, wow, if everyone sees the same thing here, maybe there's not a ton there. So it's just the reality of the drafted versus undrafted life.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I've been thinking, so when we're talking about the Conn Smythe guys, and obviously we have to see how Game 7 plays out, but if the Bruins win, I would be absolutely stunned if anyone other than Rask wins it. For the Blues, I mean, we've talked about Parayko so far. We can talk about Binnington more here in a second, but I don't know. You think, I feel like Ryan O'Reilly is kind of building up a resume here, especially with, like, it is a postseason award. It really should be the cumulative effect, but it feels like, obviously, recency bias, and especially with
it's the weighted
final. Yeah, of course. So the fact that he's really elevated his game here, where he's got 4 goals and 7 points in the last 5 games. It feels like if he has a big Game 7 effort and he leads them to victory, I think there's going to be a lot of momentum there just because of how good he's looked at both ends of the ice.
Yeah. What I wrote about him, this morning basically was that if you took one player off this Blues roster and asked him to go through this playoff run again, like who hurts him the most? We've talked about Parayko. He's a good vote. Binnington, obviously, it would hurt them, but like I could construct a scenario in my head where Jake Allen comes in, and 2 years ago he was a 935 and 11 playoff game. It's conceivable that that could happen. You know, I can see how the Blues could survive without Binnington if Allen went on a run. I can't see a situation where they're here without their number one center, guy who's put up points in whatever 7-8 straight games. I don't know how that hole would be filled, and I think they would be run over and not playing hockey right now. So that is a huge vote for me, of a guy who's probably been the most important to his team on this run, or one of the two, three guys anyway. So I certainly expect he'll receive some votes, and a good game would probably put him over the top.
Well, the thing that I love about him and watching him is he makes it easy for us as analysts, because sometimes when it comes to evaluating defensive play of forwards, it's so difficult to like distinctly point to stuff and be like, oh, I get it. That's what this guy's doing defensively that's driving the numbers, or that makes him talked about as a Selke candidate all the time. And with him, what he's been doing in this series in terms of, like, especially on the penalty kill, and I know I think Elliot Friedman brought this up on the broadcast, and it was a really astute point, but, you know, the Bruins have been giving up so many chances on their power play. It's the nature of how they play and how they want to trade chances and create off the rush on the power play, which has obviously benefited them greatly, but the drawback is that they give up quite a bit going the other way. And O'Reilly's been doing such a good job of kind of sitting around the blue line and using that active stick to create deflections, and he's had a couple of odd man rushes or breakaways on the penalty kill himself, and so just like little stuff like that, and how active he is in the defensive zone, and how he comes back all the time to get the puck and then transition it himself as opposed to relying upon the defenseman. Like, it's that stuff that makes it so much easier for us to look at and be like, yeah, that's why he's considered to be one of the best two-way forwards in the league.
Yeah, I think he's a guy, he's pure hockey IQ to me. You know, he's certainly work ethic as well, but he's hockey IQ in that, like, I don't think he's particularly fast. I don't think his shot's particularly great. He's not, you know, the biggest guy, the meanest guy, the anything. He just knows the flow of hockey. And I'm reading an interesting book right now, just about how generalists tend to prevail, and, you know, generalists versus specialists just in life in general. And it talks about how with specialists, like chess players, like, some people think they have these crazy memories, like photographic memories, for being able to look at a game board and know all the potential moves. The reality is that their memories don't back that up in other areas of life. It's just they're so familiar with the patterns and the flow of the game and how it moves in general, what the typical patterns are, that they know what to look for, what's going to come next. Ryan O'Reilly, to me, is that grandmaster chess player of hockey. He knows how hockey moves, where it's going to go, what the most likely options are. He's just always in the right lane, in the right spot. I don't know. He just strikes me as a guy who basically had skates on since when he came out of the womb. He just seems to understand the game so well. He may be one of the smartest players in the league.
Yeah, he's really fun to watch, and it's remarkable to think. And we're going to talk a bit about sort of the big winners potentially of Game 7, and Doug Armstrong is one, considering what he paid to get him this summer. And I understand there was a lot of other stuff involved there as well, and the Sabres didn't want to pay his bonus and all that, but man, he talked about a player coming in and making an immediate impact.
If you were the Buffalo Sabres and you're like, what do we need to get us where we're trying to go? Yeah. You'd be like, someone like O'Reilly. If only we could get like a number one center like that, we'd be laughing. So it's a little bit sad in that regard.
It is. It is a little bit sad. Yeah, you mentioned Binnington there, and sort of how you could envision a scenario where they could replace him with Jake Allen and still have similar results. And obviously, I mean, Jake Allen is, I don't think, a very good goalie, but he has shown in the past, and we just know that any goalie can really get hot on a 15, 20 game run. It's been weird. We were talking about Petrangelo and how there's a bit of a mismatch between how people sometimes talk about him and what we see. It's with Binnington, so like some of the praise he's been getting this postseason, I get it's a cool story from the perspective of a young goalie coming in and potentially, you know, leading a team that was in last place when he came to winning the Stanley Cup here. But I mean, just in terms of his numbers and in terms of some of the other stuff and just watching him play, like, it does feel like, I don't know what we project for him moving forward, but he's in a pretty cushy spot here with his Blues D, because it seems like structurally they make up for a lot of the mistakes he makes, or especially in terms of like preventing stuff going through the slot and making life easier for him where he can just kind of key in on shooters. I don't know. Are you as impressed as some other mainstream media members seem to be with his play?
I'm impressed by him. I think, first off, I'd like to just clarify that none of my comments about Jake Allen are Jake Allen endorsements. They're more
good. Just to be clear,
cold, goaltending in general, you know, that anyone could kind of go on a run there. But also, I think part of the praise for Binnington, it speaks to the fact that people recognize the Blues weren't a crappy team, even when they were in a crappy spot in the standings. It's just that they were being so badly let down by their goaltending. So Binnington came in and performed even average, but then above average, and was the rock the St. Louis team needed to stand on before they could show people just how solid they were throughout their whole lineup. I think it really elevated the status of Binnington and what he did. He allowed them to be the team they could be. So, you know, he got a lot of love for that, and he's certainly been riding that wave. You know, overall, his statistics are not mind-blowing by any effect, but I will say, one, I really do like watching him. I think he's positional and, you know, he's busy enough and quiet enough. I like him. I'm confident with him in net. And a lot of that has to do with his own confidence. And you've seen the big talk right now, right, is about his bounce back stats. After the Blues lose, he comes back and his numbers have been fantastic. He's not rattled by the moment. And I know the tendency from the more analytical, those with an analytical bent, is to say, you know, to sort of not give any credence to those sort of theories, that it's just another game and he's happened to play well in those games, whatever. The fact that he's not shook, the fact that he keeps bouncing back and no matter the moment continues to play well, that does say something to me about his makeup as a person. And then, so I think there's another element of it for me where maybe he's only played average, but if you're the Blues, you feel confident having a guy who's not, the moment's not too big for him. So I am a fan of his game.
I think that's fair. I think if the Blues do win and he doesn't have like a 70 save shutout or something, and he wins the Conn Smythe, I will be pretty annoyed, because I do feel like there are a couple more deserving players on this team based on this postseason.
Well, I just get annoyed how goaltenders just get this. You know, if no one does great and they win, they're like, I guess the goalie was okay.
It's true. I mean, well, in theory, we talk about this with the Hart Trophy, but like, I mean, technically by the letter of the law, like every goalie is their team's most valuable player. Like, I mean, So if they win, yeah, I guess he was their most valuable. But, okay, we're going to take a look at some Game 7 stuff and some X Factors and make some picks here in a second. Let's hear from a sponsor one more time real quick, and then we're going to wrap up the show. Sponsoring today's episode of the Hockey PDO Cast is Harry's Razors. It's fitting that we're talking about razors on today's episode of the PDO Cast, considering it is marking the end of the 2018-19 NHL season. After this last final Game 7, for those of you that have still been growing out your playoff beards, whether you're a Blues fan, a Bruins fan, or just showing your love to the sport and keeping it out for the rest of the season, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do for the summer. Now that it's heating up and it's hotter out there, you're going to be spending time at the beach, you're going to be sweating, and you want to get it more breathable, you want to get it more manageable, and you want to think ahead. So now's as good a time as any if you've been holding out to give Harry's Razors a shot, because they really are the way to go. I've been using them for a while now, and what I've really enjoyed about their product is just the closeness of the shave. They've got this kind of smooth glide where, unlike with some of the other blades I've used in the past, you don't get those kind of razor burns and those nicks and those scratches that make it off-putting to really shave. Like, I actually look forward to shaving using Harry's Razors, because they make it that easy. And considering how much time and effort we spend shaving all the time, you kind of want to figure out a long-term solution here rather than just going from one blade to another and trying to find your fit. You wanna figure it out. So why don't you join the 10 million people out there who have tried Harry's Razors by just going to harrys.com/PDO and trying our special offer and seeing if it works. I mean, they're so confident in their blades that they've got 100% quality guarantee. So if you don't love your shave, you can let them know and they'll give you a full refund. But I really do recommend it. I mean, they've stripped it down to the bare bones and they've really focused on what matters, and they've gotten away from what some of these other brands do by ripping you off and making you pay for overpriced gimmicks. I mean, all of these vibrating heads, flex balls, handles that look like a prop in a sci-fi movie, these are all just tactics that the leading brands used to overcharge us for years. All that really matters is that you're getting a quality, durable blade, and that's what Harry's prides itself on. So if you try out that special offer that I just mentioned, you're going to get a trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. You're going to get a weighted ergonomic handle for an easy grip. You're going to get a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade for a close shave. You're going to get a rich lathering shave gel that'll keep you smelling great. And you're going to get a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy on the go. So as a listener on my show, get in on this and redeem their trial set by just going to harrys.com/PDO. Make sure you go to harrys.com/PDO to redeem your offer and let them know that I sent you to help support the show. Now let's get back to Justin Bourne. All right, give me a let's go through a couple X factors or sort of predictions or what you're looking for in Game 7 in terms of what could decide this thing, because I do think we both agree that it's going to be pretty closely contested. I mean, these two teams match up really, really tightly.
Well, I'd like to first contradict myself. I called St. Louis to win this series in 7 before the series. That was my pick. And you often hear people say, so I'm sticking with that. And I'd like to say, I am changing my mind. Everything I've seen in this series to me is, again, St. Louis hanging on and Boston probably being the better team. Rask has been so solid all the way through. We know single game outcomes are just so heavily hinged on the play of goaltenders, and Rask just looks like he's on another plane right now. That we haven't seen the Bruins top guys do anything yet, and given the magnitude of the moment, I expect them to be better. I don't know, just everything in my mind, it being in Boston, is just a little bit on the Bruins side, so I'm leaning Boston. What do you got, Dimitri?
Yeah, I think the Bruins, just because they are at home and just because I do have more faith that even if they get outplayed, Rask can win this game for them, I'm going to go with them. Yeah. I think there's a very reasonable case to make that the Blues are the better team. They might not be the more skilled team, but I think they've outplayed them so far at 5-on-5, and a lot of that's to do with team health. But, I mean, Rask, we really can't sort of oversell just how good he's been. They've had 5 elimination games this year where they either could be eliminating the team or they were up backs up against the wall, and he stopped 145 out of 149 shots he's faced there. 938 save percentage. It's just all of his stats are absolutely obscene. And I was thinking in terms of the big winners of this, and if the Bruins win, like at this point, if Rask wins this and wins the Conn Smythe, he is, I know it's still early, he still has plenty of time left in his career, but he's like a no doubt about it first ballot Hall of Famer, right?
Ooh. I mean, I haven't really considered that before, but yeah, I mean...
Let me throw some stats at you. Are you ready for this?
Let's have it.
Okay, so I mean, we obviously discredit goalie wins and all that. I mean, we don't buy into it, but it does feel like if you have like over 300, it feels like this, it's kind of this like cutoff point where people like to see
maybe
that.
Maybe noteworthy.
Yeah, just, I mean, it speaks to your longevity, I guess, if anything, but... you know, he has a 920 career save percentage in the regular season. Only Dominic Hasek and Ken Dryden have better over 200 games played. 928 playoff save percentage in 90 games with guys over 50 games played. Only Braden Holtby and Tim Thomas have better numbers. So
wow, I don't even need anything after that. That's Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think so. It's like it's kind of an unassailable resume. Like we don't think about it because obviously in the generation that came before him, it was Lundqvist and Luongo, and then this one, it's kind of like Carey Price, and then I guess Braden Holtby based on his postseason resume, and maybe some other guys. And Rask kind of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit, and people like to blame him a lot because this Bruins team is always good. So if they lose, it's his fault, and if they win, we just expect him to do well. But
yeah.
Man, like if you just look at it just based on both the longevity and the actual compilation of the stats, but also the highs he's had, and especially early in his career when he came in and he was just an absolute phenom, and how he's carried it on and sort of revitalized himself this season, I do think that the resume is just like you really can't really pick it apart.
There's also like a stylistic element though to like realizing of maybe where a guy like him doesn't get as much credit or isn't thought of in that light. And I think it's because he doesn't look like the prototypical, big butterfly. Like the past generation of great goaltenders have been large blocking goaltenders by and large. And we even know that the best goaltender in the history of the NHL, Dominic Hasek, never got his due. And a lot of that is because he looked ridiculous. He looked flat out ridiculous, but he stopped the hockey puck. And Tuukka Rask has that part of his game where he will be disciplined within his save selection and all that, the goalie jargon. But at the same time, he stops the puck. He will abandon what he has to do to make those saves. So maybe he looks a little bit more flaily sometimes than other goaltenders, and you think he's kind of losing his nut or out of control. But really, he's just trying to stop the puck, and that's what great goalies do. So I'm a fan, and personally, I'm a fan of anyone who throws milk crates and loses their mind and throws their sticks. Hockey needs all the personality and excitement it can get. Tuukka has a personality. Right now, they're doing like Finnish press conferences where they're asking him weird Finnish questions, basically just to make the people at the press conference beside him uncomfortable because they don't know what's going on. I think it's just fantastic. So I am a full Tuukka Rask supporter.
I think at this point in his career, he's a bit tamer. I think he's a bit chilled out, but it would be amazing to see the Blues win, him win the Conn Smythe anyways, and then him absolutely freak out.
What's that? Sorry. I'm outside. I had a fire truck drive.
Yeah, no, I heard that. Usually the sirens are coming from my end. This is a PDO case first. No, it'd be amazing to see the Blues win, Rask win the Conn Smythe anyways, and then him just absolutely have a meltdown and just like destroy the Conn Smythe up against the glass or something.
Just pull a Shooter McGavin and just like rip across the ice and take it, just like full on book it down the hallway. I would absolutely be all for that. That would be the best outcome for me in Game 7.
Here's one of my big X factors in Game 7. So in Game 6, and throughout the series, we talk about the struggles of the top line for the Bruins, but Krejci and DeBrusk have really been quiet, and they didn't have a point through the first five games, and I believe Krejci got an assist in Game 6, but it felt like those two guys, they removed David Backes from that line, they added some speed with Carson Kuhlman, and it felt like they were really buzzing in the offensive zone and creating a bunch of chances, and I thought it was the most dangerous they've looked in some time. And just based on the way we've seen these matchups go, we know that the top lines are kind of going to go head-to-head. We know that Ryan O'Reilly's probably going to go against that Charlie Coyle, Marcus Johansson combo. So it does feel like there's an opening there for Krejci and DeBrusk to go in some softer minutes, maybe against, either the third or fourth line for the Blues. And when those guys are going, they'd really make the Bruins so much more dangerous and give them a kind of an added element with that secondary scoring punch. So I think for them to win, they're going to need another replica of the Game 6 they had, as opposed to the first five games we saw from them.
Yeah, I mean, on top of, we're talking, it's kind of incredible that the series is 3-3. I've talked about how I think Boston has been the better team, and they've, come out on top fairly handily in the games they've won. At the same time, we're saying that their top guys haven't played particularly well, and they've had next to no support scoring, really. You're right, like, Krejci's hasn't really been there, DeBrusk hasn't been there. So at some point, we need something to give here. One of these guys, whether it's top line or their secondary scorers, or that line in particular, to step up, because, Krejci hasn't been very good. Who's been really bad is Danton Heinen. Mm. This guy, he's a decent hockey player. He can create something here and there, and given, he has good line mates and he's not playing tough competition, you'd like to see a little something more out of a guy like that for Boston to step up. So those opportunities are going to be there, and it will be interesting to see if someone like that can find a way to break through.
The other big winner here, if the Blues do win, is, I guess even if they lose, we still need to command the job he's done, Craig Berube. I mean, obviously, he's a Jack Adams finalist, and everyone knows about sort of the difference he made coming in, taking over in from Mike Yeo. But when we evaluate coaches, we kind of have to preface it with saying a lot of this stuff happens behind the scenes and the preparation and sort of dealings with the players, and we aren't really privy to it. But just in terms of sort of the roster management and the personnel and how he has coordinated this postseason, I thought he's done a masterful job of sort of pushing all the right buttons and really, it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but knowing his personnel and knowing what he's working with and having a feel for it. I mean, whether they had some suspensions and injuries, but he puts Sammy Blaze in against Dallas and he immediately gives them a scoring punch. He puts in Zach Sanford and he's had a couple huge assists in this series and really felt like he got Ryan O'Reilly going a little bit in the offensive zone. And Joel Edmondson, who's a big name for them, was really struggling, and he had no issue just taking him out of the lineup and replacing him with someone else. And so whatever it's been throughout this postseason, he's been kind of one step ahead, and everything he's done has worked out. So obviously if they finish the deal here, it's going to put a nice little bow on a really magical season for him.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't have gone any better. I don't know what he would look like behind the bench of a team if you handed him Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, like a team like that with like a handful of elite talents, or even here in Toronto, some young guys with some personalities that maybe are a little, different in terms of what motivates them and how to get them going. But he just seems such a good fit for a team with enough veteran experience, enough youth in the legs, that's just hungry enough. Everything is matched up well enough. And like you said, he's got a good sense of their depth players and who to plug in where and when. And it's all sort of come up aces for him so far. So you're right. This would be one of the you know, is to the ability that we can rate coaching performances, this would be one of the best we'd ever seen since he's taken over the St. Louis Blues. There's really not a chink in the armor. It's just been flawless.
Well, and speaking of flaws, I mean, and the Blues, we mentioned Doug Armstrong in the Ryan O'Reilly trade, but I love the decisiveness with which this roster was put together. We don't typically think of the Blues that way because they've kind of been hovering around, not mediocrity, but good regular seasons and then falling short in the postseason and losing to all those Kings and Blackhawks teams over the years. But what was it? Over the past 2 years, you know, they were kind of in that playoff bubble. And then they traded away Kevin Shattenkirk first for a first-round pick in Zach Sanford. And then they traded away Paul Stastny the next year at the deadline. And those felt kind of like lateral or backwards moves. But then I think that was just the GM sort of appreciating that his team probably wasn't good enough to win a Stanley Cup that year. And he cashed in on those assets that were going to leave in free agency anyways and got future picks and prospects and so on and so forth. And then this summer, he saw a bit of an opening, and they went for it. They signed Bozak, they signed Perron, they signed Maroon, they trade for Ryan O'Reilly, and all of a sudden, you've got this great team, and it didn't happen the way we thought it would with their struggles early on in the year, but I think he's done a really good job in terms of how he's put this team together with obviously not an overflow of cash to work with.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, I hear you mention all the moves he made, and like, I hate almost every single one of them. You know, like, I felt like they've had a good team. You're right, though, that he's been honest about who they are and where they're at, but I felt like they've had a good team in any year you can win in hockey, and I felt like by taking away, Stastny or Shattenkirk, it's done a disservice to his team, to the fans, and all that, but you're right, big picture, it's the smart thing to do. Sort of what are you building towards? But then when you decide to, okay, we're going all in and you find Tyler Bozak and Patrick Maroon, you know, it's real easy to say, way to go, Doug, Bozak and Maroon, but it's worked out. He's done a brilliant, those guys have been good. They've filled necessary slots and things have certainly panned out the way he wanted them to. And now we'll look at how, at the position the team is in, having recouped the assets from the trades that they made, now being a game from the Stanley Cup, all of a sudden things are very sunny and rosy for Doug Armstrong. So it's all panned out for him. At the time, though, a lot of the groups made me skeptical.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right, obviously. I liked them before the season, and then in December, I think, obviously, people were singing a bit of a different tune, and I imagine Doug Armstrong wasn't patting himself on the back at that point. So, with recency bias, it's obviously worked out in hindsight. But no, you're right. I mean, and you mentioned Maroon and Bozak there, and Perron's the other guy they signed. And I think the commentators haven't done a good enough job in this series of mentioning how he generally is, and he has been in this series, I think, like, the biggest shit disturber on the ice. You know, we talk about Brad Marchand all the time about how he's like doing like little stuff here and there and trying to get away with stuff and poking Jordan Binnington and so on and so forth. But man, it feels like Perron is always in the middle of absolutely everything.
Yeah, and Perron's really good at making it look like he just got tangled up with someone. Like, oh boy, well, the two of us were just going at each other, and I guess the two of us got cut off, but boy, the two of us are really going at it here.
Yeah.
But it's always him. He's always one of the two, and that's that's great that he's able to draw people into that stuff. There's something to be written about that, and maybe that's something I should consider doing, about that element of the game, of what it's like playing against someone like that. It's just like, God. I remember playing in a junior hockey playoff series. And at the time, unbelievably, I was actually one of the better players on my team. And one of the other teams had one of those rats. And all he did was slash my left leg. He would never slash the right one, but it was the left leg every time. And I would see this guy coming by game 3 and 4, and I would keep my distance. I wanted nothing to do with him. Wherever he went, I was trying to stay away from him because the bruise was so bad on the back of my leg as that series went on. And it's one of those things where, like, what do you do? It just kept happening. And that frustrating pest of a player was affecting the way I played. And I think Perron and Marchand deserve a little bit of love, because I'm sure there's plenty of times guys are going out of their way to avoid those guys.
I love that. That's such psychotic behavior. Just working the one leg.
For one, like, I couldn't get a right leg slash, not once. Come on, man.
That's so good. All right, Justin. Well, I'm looking forward to this. It's obviously Game 7 Stanley Cup Final. It speaks for itself, and it's going to be a blast. And I'm looking forward to going to the beach after the game and enjoying the summer and all that good stuff. Plug some stuff. I know you wrote a bunch about the series, so let the people know where they can check that out and where they can catch you online.
Yeah, generally everything I write, I link to through Twitter. It's at JT Bourne. Otherwise, all my work is at The Athletic. And if you have to be Toronto-based, Sportsnet Fan 590, I'm on The Good Show on Mondays at 3 o'clock.
Awesome, man. Well, enjoy the Game 7, enjoy the summer, and we will check back in with you sometime down the road. This was a blast.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Dimitri.
Cheers.
On Twitter at Dim Filipovich and on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/hockeypediocast.